Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. For the better part of a century, the only successful political coup in American history remained buried by disinformation and, later, neglect. The coup occurred in Wilmington, North Carolina, where white supremacists used a combination of lies, propaganda, and violence to overturn the local government. It was a government atypical of its era, with power shared by a mix of white and black leaders. They were part of the political movement known as Fusion. Dozens, if not hundreds, of black residents died in the coup. The pain and loss caused by the racial terrorism of November 1898 reverberates to the present. Black citizens made up 56% of Wilmington's population at the time of the coup. Soon after, whites became the majority. Today, 74% of Wilmington's population is white. A new documentary, American Coup, Wilmington 1898, tells the story of those tragic events through the voices of descendants, historians, and recreations of the principal players. Here is historian Kadada Williams, featured in the documentary discussing how white reporters falsely portrayed the insurrection as a black riot.
A lot of white newspapers use the language of race riot, which suggests that black people are the aggressors. Or they will reframe it as violence between black and white people, as though black people are instigating the violence and white people are only defending themselves, which we know is absolutely not happening here.
American Coup will debut on PBS on November 12th and be available for streaming at pbs.org. With me today to discuss Wilmington's painful history and what can be learned from these tragic events are Brad Lichtenstein. He is the co-director, co-writer, and co-producer of American Coup. Also here is David Zucchino. In 2020, he published Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. It won the Pulitzer Prize in 2021. He also appears in the documentary. Brad, David, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Thank you very much for having us.
Brad, I'll begin with you. What led you to this story and ultimately this documentary?
Well, the truth is I was very fortunate to be asked to direct this with my colleague, Yoruba Richin. We were asked by PBS North Carolina, which had a desire to tell this story because obviously it took place in North Carolina, and to tell it thoroughly and in the manner that PBS standards have grown in terms of the expectations of the audience to be truthful and thorough. So it really was commissioned. And part of the reason why I think they were interested in Yoruba and I is because we have a long history of making films about race and social justice.
And David, your book came out almost 5 years ago now and helped raise awareness of a part of our history that, as I mentioned, went ignored and unknown for decades, and it remains under-acknowledged in a lot of ways. How did participating in this documentary deepen or affect your view of these events that you already knew from researching your book?
It made me realize just how unusual this event was. You know, I'd stepped away from it for a little while and dove back in, and that just jumps out at you as just how remarkable it is that something like this could happen in the United States and we wouldn't know about it, and that the perpetrators were able for so many years to just bury it and mischaracterize it and do it so successfully. So to me, it was very gratifying that PBS and American Experience wanted to bring this story to a wider audience.
Newspapers play a central role in these events. One example, Rebecca Felton, the wife of a Georgia congressman, gave a speech condemning white men for failing to aggressively stamp out a rape epidemic perpetrated by black men against white women. One problem with that, there was no rape epidemic. Felton made up the accusations to stir racial tension. But white supremacists reprinted her speech in Wilmington in August 1898, and Alex Manley, editor of Wilmington's black newspaper, fired back with this editorial.
Experience among poor white people in the country teaches us that women of that race are not more particular in the matter of clandestine meetings with colored men than are the white men with colored women. Meetings of this kind go on for some time until the women's infatuation or the man's boldness brings attention to them, and the man is lynched for rape. Every Negro lynched is called a big, burly black brute, when in fact, many of those who have thus been dealt with had white men for their fathers and were not only not black and burly, but were sufficiently attractive for the white girls of culture and refinement to fall in love with them.
What happened after that? No spoiler alert that bad things happened after that, but what happened after that?
Well, what happened after that was that the editorial was used as a way to fire up people in this white supremacy campaign that ultimately led to the coup and massacre and to Alex Manley having to leave town or else he would have been killed. That's sort of the broad strokes. David?
The coup planning was already underway by August of 1898, but this was sort of a gift from the point of view of the perpetrators, and it just fell into their laps. And as Brad mentioned, they could use this for political purpose to really, they've been whipping up black men to go out and attack, white men to go out and attack black men all that summer, but this just intensified things. And then just to show you how this was planned ahead of time, the red shirts, who are the militia of the of the white supremacist movement, the vigilantes, they wanted to lynch Alex Manley that very day and burn down his newspaper. And the leaders of the white supremacy movement said, no, now's not the time. Let's wait till closer to the election in November. And that would have a great, much greater political impact. And we promise you then you can lynch Alex Manley and you can burn down the newspaper. So this really, really intensified the anger and the resentment among whites and ratcheted up to a whole new level.
Go ahead, Brad.
I was just going to add that, you know, to bring this into sort of contemporary feeling is, of course, this is 1898. Newspapers are the way that information is being shared and disseminated rapidly across the population. It's really no different than social media today. So if you can imagine, this editorial got reprinted by newspapers all over the country, and it was used the same way that a meme might be used today to stir up fear and to stir up anger.
Who could imagine such things in contemporary America? David, I'm curious. You just mentioned, though, that how strategic this was, not just the propaganda and the misinformation, but that even the violence was going to be carried out in specific ways at specific times to get the maximum reaction.
Yeah, this was all planned, and it shows you the control that the leadership have over the men in the streets. This thing was a top-down affair with the leadership really dictating the timing and really controlling the violence and then just letting it all go on November 10th. And that was a day they had planned for some time in advance. They were going to steal the election, which was 2 days before on the 8th, and they're going to use that position to then overthrow the local government because it wasn't up for election during the midterm elections. They weren't up for election until the following March, and they decided, well, they would just get rid of the government that very day, and they did rise up and take over.
That's the voice of David Zucchino. He is the author of Wilmington's Lie. Also with us is Brad Lichtenstein. He is the co-director, co-writer, and co-producer of American Coup. Manley is one figure. Josephus Daniels, publisher of the Raleigh News and Observer, is the other major media figure in this story. And they're telling very different stories. Manley's were factual. Daniels were not. So how did Josephus Daniels play into all of these events as they swirled around Wilmington?
Well, I'll start. I'm sure David can fill in details, but big picture, Josephus Daniels ran the newspaper with the largest circulation in the state of North Carolina and had a lot of influence as a result. And he was making up these lies in cahoots with the other leaders of the white supremacy campaign. We talked already about the trope that white men were raping white women as if there was some kind of epidemic. The other term that he used incessantly was Negro rule. So even though there was a multiracial government, it wasn't like it was split 50-50. Mm-hmm. There were a few Black leaders in power, certainly not an overwhelming majority. But the way that he hammered it home in the newspaper was to constantly say that there was Negro rule, that Black people were not capable, and that Black people were like vampires. They were sucking the life out of the populace through this kind of role in leadership. And he also understood that a lot of his readers, or a lot of the population, were not literate. White readers were not literate. So the cartoons became a central part of this disinformation campaign, depicting Negro rule as a Black incubus, as a creature that was clawing away power, wreaking havoc on the white population, for instance.
And again, David, I thought that was really interesting. What Brad just said, the fact that Josephus Daniels was smart enough, awful enough to come up with this strategy of, a lot of people aren't going to be able to read the propaganda that I'm disseminating, so I'll give them pictures too.
Yeah, this whole effort was very well thought out and very well planned, and they really thought of everything. And I should mention that Josephus Daniels, in addition to being a newspaper publisher, was the top leader of the Democratic Party, which at that time was the party of white supremacy. So he wore two hats, and he wore those hats during the whole white supremacy campaign. In fact, he and a man named Furnival Simmons, who was the chairman of the Democratic Party in North Carolina, originally met in March of 1898 to start planning the coup and the violence and the theft of the election. So those two were really pivotal figures. And Josephus, from his perch as the publisher of the most powerful and influential newspaper in the state, really, really used that power effectively, as Brad had pointed out.
And Brad, let's back up and set the scene of Wilmington in the 1880s and 1890s. While Reconstruction had unraveled across the South and the rest of North Carolina, Wilmington was still a place where Black people held power. They owned businesses. They thrived in the working class and as doctors and other occupations. Here is historian Crystal Sanders and David.
So we see Black and white men on the Board of Aldermen. We see Black and white men serving in various municipal offices.
10 of the 26 policemen were Black men, the city treasurer, the city jailer, the city coroner. John C. Dancy was the custom collector at the port, which is a federally appointed position. He made $4,000 a year, which is $1,000 more than the governor made.
So why did Wilmington end up in this unique position?
Well, I can start off again, and then David certainly can fill in more details. But the thing about Wilmington is that it was a port city, that it had an industry that was healthy in terms of being able to ship out the kinds of products that were made from the natural resources, from the forests, like turpentine. And so there was a room to hire Black stevedores, for instance, on the ships and to load the ships. And then, as you mentioned, and as Crystal mentioned, there was also this burgeoning Black middle class that included professionals. There's a image that we use in the film that shows Blacks and whites at the marketplace together, which was very unusual. So this was what society looked like.
We're going to leave this as a cliffhanger. We're going to get David's perspective on the professional and working class Wilmington. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we're continuing our conversation about the new American Experience documentary, American Coup, Wilmington, 1898. It debuts on PBS November 12th and will be streaming at pbs.org and on the PBS app. With me today are two key figures in the film. Brad Lichtenstein is co-director, co-producer, and co-writer of the documentary. While David Zucchino is featured prominently throughout as one of the experts on the coup, he is the author of Wilmington's Lie, which won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction in 2021. Brad was telling us a little bit right before the break about how and why Wilmington was atypical for its time. David, some of your thoughts on how it wound up in that position.
Yeah, Brad had mentioned that Wilmington was a major port and also a center for the naval stores industry, which is tar, pitch, and turpentine. But in addition, it was also a railroad terminus. So between those three industries, there were a lot of manual labor jobs available and more jobs than the whites could handle. And if you recall, if we've mentioned earlier, Wilmington was 56% Black. And then that drew more Black people after Reconstruction to the city because there were so many jobs available. And Blacks ended up taking these jobs. And in just less than a generation, many of them had moved up into the middle class and started businesses like, you know, restaurants and laundries and blacksmith shops. So where there was a really thriving working class, middle class, and as we mentioned earlier, a small professional class.
One of the things, Brad, that you do in this film is you bring it to the future, or the contemporary, I should say, not the future.
I appreciate that credit. Yes.
Yeah, the future from 1898. That's what I'm trying to say. By speaking to a lot of the descendants of people on all sides of these events, one of them is Lucy McCauley. Her great-grandfather, William Barry McCoy, was a lawyer and Princeton graduate who ran the white government unions, which is exactly what it sounds like. And she tells you that the coup and the attack on Black residents was never discussed. How does she reckon with that history, and how difficult or not was it for you to get her to speak to you about that history?
Sure. Well, Lucy McCauley is a descendant, as you mentioned, of a person who was part of the white government unions and who helped to orchestrate the white supremacy campaign. But Lucy McCauley, is rare among white descendants because she was already in the process of doing repair work, both in terms of healing and in conversations with descendants from the Black families that were banished or maligned or murdered on that day. But also she herself had established a scholarship. It was a form of reparation that she established because it was a way to, honor a Black family that had also been connected in her family history to her. So in a way, she was a little bit of an aberration. Other white descendants that participated in the film actually had not really known all that much about their past. And a lot of that is because it was so thoroughly buried. You know, it was buried institutionally, whether it was textbooks that wrote lies or repeated lies, but did not tell the truth, but also in families. I talked to a lot of white descendants, some of whom participated in the film, many of whom did not, who said this was just something that we never talked about in our families. And I can think of a couple of white descendants whose names are recognizable from the coup and from the massacre, who not only declined to participate, but that they claimed no relationship to those people who had taken part in those events in November and in the months leading up to it. So, my feeling is that it takes a certain amount of courage for both the Black and white descendants to tell their truth in this film. One of them, for instance, is Frank Daniels, who you mentioned before, the newspaper, Josephus Daniels, who was the publisher and editor at the News and Observer. And he not only spoke in the film, but he and his contemporaries, his family that ran the newspaper in more contemporary times, had a statue of their great-grandfather or their ancestor, depending on who they are in relation, taken down from in front of where the offices of the newspaper used to be, because they understood that he didn't deserve the veneration that he was given for almost 100 years afterwards.
And Josephus Daniels, publisher of the News and Observer, he went on to become Secretary of the Navy. Other conspirators went on to serve as governor. Another one was in the United States Senate for, I think, 30 years. David, was there ever any semblance of investigation or prosecution after this coup?
There really wasn't. McKinley was president then, and he was an abolitionist, had fought in the Union Army, and had actually relied on Black votes in part to get elected, and I believe was the first candidate on the campaign trail to speak to a Black audience. But he, as far as I could find, never mentioned the coup in public, never made one mention of it. Before the coup, a congressman from North Carolina and a delegation of Black ministers went to McKinley and told him what was about to happen, warned him and said there was violence coming, Black men are going to be murdered, we're going to be deprived of the right to vote, and McKinley didn't do anything. They'd ask him to send the federal troops down to guarantee Blacks' right to vote. After the coup, that same delegation went back up with the congressman, just said, you know, here, told him what had happened, explained it, and he just refused to get involved, which I found very, very curious. But I just believe that he needed white votes more. There was an election coming up. He was going to run for re-election, and he needed the white votes more than the Black votes, and the Black votes were going to be basically disappear from the election. So I think he made a hard, calculated political decision, although I couldn't find anything in his memoirs talking about that, so I'm only speculating there.
And Brad, I think one of the things that you point out in the film, if I recall correctly, is that part of the reason for the coup is that it was an election year, but it was not an election year for municipal races. And so the white-black power sharing would continue, but for the actions of Josephus Daniels and others.
That's right. And as David mentioned right at the top, the coup took place 2 days after the massacre, and that completed the job, so to speak. That unseated the government, the municipal government, and replaced everybody who was a fusionist or who was Black with not just whites, but mostly people who had been part of the orchestration of the coup itself, people who were members of the so-called Secret Nine, or people who had been part of the Chamber of Commerce, the city leaders. In fact, the last seat was taken by Hugh McCrae. Hugh McCrae, that last name is well known in Wilmington. There was a park named after them, other institutions. And in one of the parts of the film that always moves me the most is when Hugh McCrae's great-great-granddaughter, Meg McCrae, talks about that part. You know, we had the good fortune that descendants agreed to read part of the original record. And so she reads that part. And, you know, even though it happened 100 years ago, it is still, I think, a wrenching thing to sort of take in, especially as a descendant of someone who was part of the coup.
David, I'm curious, with all of the research you did you get into any of the contemporary circumstances of Wilmington or descendants?
Towards the end of the book, I write a couple of chapters about attempts at reconciliation, particularly in 1998, which was the centennial of the coup. The University of North Carolina at Wilmington organized a symposium, and it brought together Black and white descendants. And there was some progress towards really bringing people together, and quite a bit of progress towards acknowledging what really happened, that it was a white vigilante uprising and not a Black race riot. But when the subject of reparations came up, everything kind of broke down, and it really ended sort of on a sour note because of that, where there were many, many white descendants and just white residents who absolutely refused to even consider the possibility and were offended by it.
You can see the body language in the footage that's included in the documentary when the idea of reparations comes up, Brad.
Well, I was just going to add, yes. And one of the people in our film is Inez Eason Campbell, whose ancestor was a person who sat on the board and also ran a bank and a savings and loan, respectively. And they had amassed wealth, and they lost all of it as a result of the coup and the massacre. And she is one of the participants in that commemoration and sequence of events in 1998 that David mentioned. In fact, you know, in the film, you see her talk about the fact that there has to be a place to express anger because of so much loss. And the reception she gets for her comment is also very awkward and cool. So you can see that the town is just starting to come to terms with its history 100 years later. And of course, as David mentioned, reparations was not received well at that time. And today, the group that introduced us to many of the descendants coming to the table, which really grew out of the Black and white sides of the Thomas Jefferson family meeting each other and having conversation. There's a group in Wilmington that talks about this very subject, and they have started the work to propose different ideas for how reparations might work. And I can say, just as an observer of this process, and there's a teeny weeny bit of it in the film, you know, there's a very long road ahead of them.
And I would just add, one fairly major accomplishment has been the acknowledgement that this was not a Black riot, but that this was an attempt at a political coup by the white supremacy movement. And there's a historical marker, the first one, that was put up acknowledging what happened. It replaced, it added to a marker for Alex Manley, but there was one there for years and years, but his does not mention that this was a coup. It just calls it a riot. So I think that shows some progress. And also there's a memorial that was set up a few years ago that honors the victims and tells it completely and honestly what really happened.
And Manley, of course, was the Black publisher and editor of the Black Daily in Wilmington, who we heard the words from that editorial earlier. You know, we talk about coup, and in some ways it almost sounds quaint to hear that word. It doesn't fully convey how frightening these events were. Here's Kieran Hale, who's the great-great-grandson of Alex Manley, speaking with his wife Priscilla about the horrors of that day.
Felice Sagewar, who was one of the Sagewar sisters, she remembers being young and held in the rushes of the Cape Fear River, hiding out that night, that November 10th.
And her father had to hold her mouth down from screaming as dead bodies passed them through the water.
Did these firsthand accounts, did they exist readily? Did you have to dig for them? Give me an idea of how obvious or not this history is and was.
Well, from the film perspective, I would say that a lot of these accounts have not been given by these particular descendants. I know that, you know, at the time that David wrote his book, some of the descendants who are in our film, he spoke to, some of them honestly had not even known about their own family's history until 2021, when there was a commemoration. And during that commemoration, there was a special burial service for Joshua Halsey, who is one of the people whose name we know and some of the facts we know about how he died during the coup, during the massacre. And the Halsey family came to the soil ceremony, where soil was gathered. Some of it is now at the museum that's associated with the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery. And now there's a headstone that marks his grave in the cemetery where Black families are buried. And so some of those strands of the family had never even met each other, let alone really understood their connection to Joshua Halsey.
The terrorism and the violence that played out got much worse when North Carolina Governor Daniel Russell was tricked into authorizing martial law against Black residents. Here is Larae Sykes Umfleet, followed by David.
Once word was received at the Wilmington Light Infantry headquarters that shots were being fired in Brooklyn in the north end of town, Walker Taylor sends a telegram to Governor Russell.
Colonel Walker Taylor, one of the leaders of the white supremacy campaign, duped the governor, saying the Blacks are rioting. And so he authorized Walker Taylor to bring out the militia, declare martial law, and that unleashed the militia against the Black population.
David, one thing I wondered about is, did the governor, although I fear I know the answer to this question, did the governor ever accept responsibility for what he unleashed that day?
No, he did not. He had very little to say about it. He was completely cowed and intimidated by the white supremacists. He was from Wilmington and had been part of the planter gentry. Was related directly to some of the perpetrators, or by marriage, or they were friends or school chums. They knew him very well, and they knew how to play him. And they just threatened. Well, they threatened to lynch him. They threatened to drive him from office. He was intimidated, and I don't know this for a fact, but I'm wondering whether he was actually duped or whether he knew what he was doing and just went along. I have no idea. I have no way of knowing that. But afterwards, he had very little to say and just sort of disappeared from public life. He couldn't run again, and he did not run again.
In the film, it's pointed out that the overthrow of Wilmington ended any racial progress for the next 60 years until the Civil Rights Movement, as played out across the South. And it would take 90 years before North Carolina elected a black representative to Congress again. How do you think these events, we talked about the reparations and the discomfort with that, but how do you think these events affect present-day Wilmington beyond the reparations conversation?
Sure. Well, a number of people that we've met and talked to can point to the ways in which what used to be the area of Wilmington that was thriving and growing, as we talked about early in the program, with a black middle class and burgeoning wealth, has really been either relegated to relative poverty or gentrified. By white real estate interests. There's other ways in which people have talked to us about the way in which services are lesser than in what remains of the black area of town. There's subsequent events that have happened that have to do with education and the schools. And in that way, Wilmington's no different than most cities in America. I mean, we've all seen, inequity and inequality grow. What makes it different is that it had this kind of shining moment that seemed like it might crest over that hill and then continue the progress. And that, of course, was completely eradicated.
Time for one more break. Stay with us as our conversation continues on the coup of Wilmington in 1898. This is Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guests today are Brad Lichtenstein, who co-directed, co-produced, and co-wrote the new documentary American Coup, Wilmington, 1898. Also here is author and journalist David Zucchino. He's featured in the new documentary and wrote Wilmington's Lie, a Pulitzer-winning account of the coup. American Coup premieres on PBS November 12th and can also be streamed on the PBS app and at pbs.org. David, I'd like to bring you in for perspective on contemporary Wilmington.
Yeah, we were talking about the effects of the coup, and they were very, very profound and long-lasting and continue to this day. Back in 1898, Wilmington was 56% black. Today, it's 18% black. As we mentioned, it had a thriving middle class. Today, the middle class is tiny. It's nothing like it was. Basically, this coup interrupted really an arc of progress for blacks in Wilmington, and it just cut it off. Deprived them, as we spoke earlier, of institutional wealth, but also of any political power. Black people did not vote in any significant numbers for nearly 60 to 70 years after the coup. So there's no black political power that was being built over this time. There was no black capital being built. And they're still trying to recover. On the other hand, whites really profited from what happened there in political power and economic power. And today, whites dominate the city. It's no longer segregated formally, but one resident described to us as the two races being comfortably separated now. And I think that's a good way to put it, and that's probably true of a lot of American cities.
Brad, to that point, one of the most powerful moments in your film to me is a sequence in which Carol Anderson, the eminent historian from Emory University, says, people say, why don't Black people just pick themselves up and lift themselves up by their bootstraps? And they ignore the fact of what was stolen and taken from them. Lives, most obviously and most tragically, but also wealth, any kind of accumulation of social capital, financial capital, all those things. And Wilmington really illustrates that, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, I think that there is this lie that perpetuates in white communities across America that meritocracy is somehow something that doesn't, that exists in a vacuum, and that we can ignore history and just think that, you know, people will achieve according to their abilities without regard to the institutional and, in this case, violent barriers and the way in which white terror has played such a role in taking power and wealth and lives away from Black people from the beginning in this country. There was a woman who stood up at our premiere at Hot Springs Documentary Film Festival, a Black woman, who said, thank you, this film makes me feel like I'm not crazy. And my response to her too was, thank you, because making this film reminds me that I'm not crazy. I grew up in the South. I grew up in a family that very often denied these kinds of events happened, or if they acknowledged they happened, did not think that they had any kind of impact on the present. So, you know, we all live in this sort of, you know, atmosphere of white denial. It's one of the reasons we made the film.
David, I'm curious, you have had a long career in journalism, and you won a Pulitzer Prize covering apartheid in South Africa in the late 80s. I'm guessing you see some parallels and perhaps some contrasts here without creating a college essay assignment for you. How do these events compare with what you saw in South Africa?
Yeah, in South Africa, it was institutionalized to a greater degree. The separation of the races was mandated by law, even to a greater extent than existed after Reconstruction in the South and in Wilmington. But the use of violence is the real parallel that I see, because apartheid was built on violence and maintained through violence. I covered the townships in the last few years of apartheid when they were rising up, and the South African authorities really used militias and the military in the same way that the white leadership did in Wilmington to suppress the Black population, to intimidate them. And they used a lot of the same techniques, and then used a whole lot of misinformation and disinformation through the news media to mischaracterize what Black citizens were trying to achieve in South Africa. They called them communists and instigators and rabble rousers and thugs, the same kind of language that we heard in Wilmington. So I could go on, but there are quite a few parallels.
For both of you, because you're both immersed in this subject, not just of Wilmington, but of race relations, race in America. We know that is so much the foundation of our country's history, good and often for worse. Does that make you want to delve into additional stories along these lines? Have you thought about that?
I'll go first. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, my formative experience in life happened when I was 15 years old here in Atlanta, Georgia, where I grew up. And I got the chance to work for Congressman John Lewis when he was running for office. And being immersed in his world and being around him and having, you know, the supreme gift of a lifelong friendship with him really set me on my course. So my hope is, you know, as long as I have breath in my body, I want to continue to tell these stories about America. And, you know, from the way I see it, race is just baked into the DNA of America. So those stories have to be about race and justice.
Yeah, David, I'm curious. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'm very concerned about attempts by conservatives now, white conservatives, to basically, and to use the term, whitewash history, to erase history. We saw it in Florida, especially. with a law that was passed that really constricts what can be taught in the schools, and it really, really undermines the telling of true stories. There's been an attempt in the North Carolina legislature to pass a similar law. So I think it's really, really important to dig up these forgotten episodes of history or history that's been denied and expose it to the light and tell the truth, because there is a real movement, a political movement in this country to try to suppress that.
Well, and one of the things that brought that to mind, other than the obvious of what the documentary is about, is as I was going back and kind of collecting my thoughts, it finally dawned on me that roughly 23 years, I think, after Wilmington's coup, comes the race massacre in Tulsa and Black Wall Street. And that's another historical event that really until the past decade, maybe, I don't remember hearing that in school ever. I don't remember people talking about it. I don't even remember there may have been a couple documentaries, but you know what I'm saying? It was not in the public consciousness. So does that make the two of you naturally wonder how many more stories out there are like this in our history? And Brad, I'll let you start.
Well, sure. I mean, one thing to point out is that there were roughly 170, probably more, massacres that occurred between the Civil War and Tulsa. And one of the reasons why we know more about Tulsa is because the white supremacists who committed that massacre, they had a biplane, and they also had the new technology of the day, a film camera that they mounted on that biplane. So we have film footage that shows those atrocities. And so many documentaries at the anniversary got made in part because there was that documentation, but there's not a lot of documentation for these others. And if you just walk through the lynching memorial in Montgomery, you get the feeling, the literal heaviness of how much violence occurred in America during this period. And of course, continued to occur. I mean, I'm wearing, I just realized, a t-shirt for Worlis Jackson. Yoruba and I made a film about a man in Natchez, Mississippi, who was murdered by the Klan because he dared to be part of a group, the Deacons for Defense, that fought back with arms against white terror during the civil rights movement. And that's another thing to talk about, that in the civil rights movement, for years and years, the standard narrative was only about peaceful nonviolence. But there was plenty of resistance, armed resistance to white terror throughout that period as well. I guess in short, there's no shortage of stories to tell.
David, I'm curious. Have you already selected your next book topic? And is it in any way related to this, or are you going in another direction?
I have several possibilities, and I'm always looking for a good story, a nonfiction story. At the moment, nothing I'm considering is directly related to this, but I'm certainly open. I know there are a lot of those untold stories out there, and I'm digging around, seeing what I can find.
Brad, as we've discussed, you interviewed descendants of the historical figures on all sides of the coup, and you include these contemporary scenes of residents from Wilmington. And I think one of the North Carolina nods that serves you best is the music and voice of Rhiannon Giddens. For those unfamiliar with her name, she is a Grammy and MacArthur Genius Grant winner. She is a renowned singer, folk musician, and she contributed a haunting theme song to this documentary. She also did some voiceover work for you. Tell me a little bit about how you came to get her involved in this project.
Sure. I mean, how lucky am I? I get to hang out with Pulitzer Prize winners and MacArthur Genius Grant winners. So when we first started, we learned that Rhiannon Giddens, and also a writer who's based in Wilmington, who, excuse me, contributes to such outlets like the New York Times, John Jeremiah Sullivan, who's also in the film. We learned that the two of them were working on an opera. And when we found that out, we thought, oh, this might be an interesting part of the story that we tell. Now, Rhiannon won a Grammy, and suddenly she was booked 500 dates in a 365-day year. So, you know, that had to take a back seat. But she was generous enough, and her team, to rework some of the songs. So that 1898 song that you mentioned, she rearranged for us for use in the film. And then we also use a couple of her other tunes too that are wildly appropriate. And as you pointed out, she also voices a couple of the historical characters. She's just, there's nothing that Rhiannon ever attempts to do that doesn't turn out to be gold.
But it sounds like she was very interested from the start to do this.
Oh, absolutely. And obviously she's smart. She won the genius award. She, is really someone who knows this history, and being a North Carolina native, really wants this history to be out there, to be told as well.
David, what do you think this film will do to further spread the word that your book did so well? But as we all know, it's a visual society. So how do you think that enhances what you have started?
Well, I think it'll reach millions of people. I hope it does directly and indirectly. It's really important to tell this story visually as well as in words. And I'm really glad the American Experience is doing it. And we're all familiar with the show. It is a terrific, terrific program, always well-researched and always really, really deeply reported. So I think it'll have a tremendous impact in just spreading this story across the country.
Brad, tell me a little bit about your approach visually. You employ the silhouettes, and you have an interesting mix of, you know, not just the talking heads, but illustrations and recreations, if you will. What's the balance there? What was in your mind as you're trying to figure out the best way to convey the story without trivializing it?
Sure. Well, from the outset, we knew that we were going to have to figure out a language visually because, you know, even though we used over 500 photographs and text, you know, original text material from the time, it's still a movie, right? So we have to figure out a visual language. Yoruba and I knew about an artist, Kara Walker, whose work is silhouettes and also comments on inaccurate history. So we actually went to go see a show of hers at the City University, City Museum in New York, that was of Harper's magazine excerpts with her silhouettes in sort of a position of commentary on these lies in history that were written about the Civil War. And that was part of the inspiration for us. We also were really taken by the silhouettes, the puppets, shadow puppetry in the Candyman remake that Jordan Peele did. Mm-hmm. And so that started as kind of, you know, the base of a stew. And then we started to work with an artist named Xavier Ruffin. He started to throw all of his ingredients into it. And then also as we got deeper and deeper into the edit and realized how much we were relying on these old newspapers, old photographs, we understood too that we need something that kind of worked in sync with them, that, you know, felt like it was a piece of that. So we landed on this illustration and animation that has a lot of the same color palette, the same sort of sepia tones and antique feeling, but also feels contemporary in, you know, the rendering to help tell the story. And, you know, my hat's off to Xavier. He just did an amazing job.
And as we come into the closing moments here, the other thing I'm wondering is, what, if anything, have you heard from the residents of Wilmington? Will you seek out their thoughts and opinions as this gets out into the world?
Oh, well, we have a very big screening on Thursday in Ballion Hall, the very place where Alfred Waddell and the white supremacist movement gave their speeches to whip into fear and frenzy the population to carry out these deeds. So it will be a very interesting screening, and I can't wait for it.
Well, that is going to have to be the last word. Brad Lichtenstein and David Zucchino are key figures in the new documentary, American Coup, Wilmington, 1898. It premieres November 12th on PBS and will be streaming at pbs.org. Brad, David, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Eric.
Total pleasure. Thanks for having us on and for asking such great questions.
For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.